morning, we want to welcome James Madison Academic Council. Would those please rise? We're delighted to welcome you all here today. You may be seated. The court has a program called Court with Class, and it is sponsored by the State Bar and this court. It has a very clever title, and it has won national awards. And the purpose of the program is to invite people to come to the court, listen to oral argument, and then learn about the procedures of the court in taking cases, hearing cases, and deciding cases. So we're very happy to welcome James Madison Academic Council to participate with us today in this oral argument, at least by listening, having learned something about the case. And then a meeting with a justice after this case is completed. If anyone would like a summary of this case, would you raise your hand, please? All right. I'm going to now introduce the court to all of you. Starting on my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Pat Rogensack. Justice Rogensack will meet with the class after this argument. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her right is an empty chair. Ordinarily, Justice David Prosser sits there. He will not be participating in this case. And on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I will call our second case this morning, 09AP3075, State versus Basil E. Ryan, Jr. Representing Mr. Ryan is attorney Dan Beersdorf. Mr. Beersdorf, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Members of the court, respected counsel, we're here today to basically address three issues. One issue is judicial estoppel. The second issue is the relationship of summary judgment with regards to forfeiture proceedings. And the third issue has to do with the application of Commerce Rule 202. I'm going to start out with the issue of judicial estoppel, and I'm going to try and avoid addressing anything that we've specifically submitted to the court in our written submissions. You've either had a chance to read them, or I assume that you will take an opportunity after this hearing to address any of the points that are there. But one of the burning question with regards to judicial estoppel, as far as this case is concerned, is why should judicial estoppel not be applied? The Circuit Court applied it. The Court of Appeals applied it. We've appealed that ruling here to this court. So the question is, why should it not apply? I'm going to answer that question. And the explanation that I give here today is not contained in any of our written materials. In fact, I really kind of discovered it as I was preparing for these oral arguments with the court. But what I'm going to be doing is the explanation I'm going to give is going to come right out of the state's brief to you folks. And I'm going to start by looking at page 37 of their brief. And what that page addresses, I'm going to address the issue there. And the issue says preclusion, which does not apply here, is distinct from judicial estoppel, which does. This is now the contention of the state. I'm now reading down in the middle of the second paragraph. This is the state's writing. The issue of Ryan's or Ryan's company's ownership or control of the barge was not actually litigated. We're now talking in the writ case, the original case that we're dealing with here. We have the writ case, the original case. We're dealing with the barge case, so I will use those terms during the course of these arguments. Let me start that again with that preface. Referring now to the writ case, the state writes, the issue of Ryan's or Ryan's company's ownership or control of the barge was not actually litigated. Rather, it was assumed by the circuit court and never challenged by Ryan in issuing the writ requiring that Ryan and his companies remove their barge. Going down to the bottom of that page in the paragraph there, it starts out, it says, the principles of preclusion and judicial estoppel are distinct. Okay? Then we continue on at the bottom where it says, judicial estoppel prohibits a party from asserting in litigation a position that is contrary to and inconsistent with a position asserted previously in the litigation by that party. And they cite the Godfrey case. We previously had pointed out to the court as well, and this is on, it's referenced a couple of pages in our submissions, but it comes in page 10 of our reply brief where we cite Sea View. The third element that Sea View addresses that is important for judicial estoppel, it says this, and this is, I'm quoting now the court, the party to be estopped must have convinced the first court to adopt its position. So with the words from Seaview and the words from Godfrey now in our mind, let's go back and once again read what the state just wrote and which I just read a moment ago. The issue of Ryan's or Ryan's company's ownership or control of the barge was not actually litigated. Rather, it was assumed by the circuit court and never challenged by Ryan. What does that mean? That means that in the writ case, Ryan didn't make any position. He didn't assert anything, as Godfrey requires. He didn't convince the court, as Seaview requires, as the state acknowledges. In the writ case, the circuit court made an assumption. They made an assumption that Ryan or Ryan's companies owned or controlled the barge. Ryan never took a position, as the state has acknowledged. So judicial estoppel fails. We have addressed all the reasons in our submissions, but here, right here in the state's brief, and they couldn't have said it any, or I couldn't have said it any better than they did. The reason it fails is because Ryan never challenged the assumption by the circuit court. So for the first court proceeding to be considered a part of judicial estoppel, you have to have an assertion made by the party, and it has to have convinced that earlier court. By the state's own admission, that never occurred.
Counsel.
Yes.
Make an interesting argument. The trial court, though, said, as a defendant in State v. 260, Mr. Ryan and his corporate concerns affirmatively asserted ownership of the barge. That's what it says.
Not to the court.
Pardon me?
It was never asserted to the court.
Then they say they did so in the relocation business questionnaire, Exhibit A. They did so in Markovitz's letter on behalf of Ryan, dated October 16. And so the relocation of business questionnaire was not in court. That was the agency, right?
Yes, the questionnaire was never submitted to the court.
Okay. What about Mr. Markovitz's letter on behalf of Mr. Ryan, where he said they'd removed the barge but reserved...
That letter wasn't written until after the court proceeding was done.
Okay.
So that couldn't have been used to convince the court.
And then it says, and most importantly, said the circuit court, they agreed to entry of an order which specifically determined that the barge was the personal property of Ryan or a Ryan concern, citing the order for writ of assistance. Now, that was a court document, right?
Fine.
Fine how? Come. You agreed to the entry of the order?
I wasn't the attorney in charge at that point in time. Let's assume that they did.
Yeah.
And because the record is the record. Let's assume that they did. We still have to go back and find and determine, how does that fact, how does that event relate to judicial estoppel? For judicial estoppel to apply, there has to be an assertion and a convincing of the court of a position. The court was not convinced of any position. It was just a stipulation. But here's the point. You have to understand, why was the stipulation entered at that point in time?
What stipulation?
If the stipulated order that you're talking about, right, if they did agree to that, and if it meant that, the question is there's a question as to whether what the word owner there means, whether it was talking about the owner of the barge or owner of the property. But let's just not worry about that for a moment. The fact of the matter is that why would they care? Ownership was not an issue in that case. It was not being litigated, as the state has even acknowledged. It wasn't litigated in the case. So if it meant owner of the property or it meant owner of the barge, who would care? It was not something that was meant to mislead anybody. It was simply something that everybody said, hey, for the issue that we're dealing with here, possession of the property, it's not a big deal. It's not a question that has to be addressed. So if anything, if there was going to be an issue that where that would be an issue, it would be collateral estoppel. It would not be judicial estoppel, because judicial estoppel requires an assertion and a convincing of the court. The fact that the court is signing off on an order that the parties have stipulated to is not, in my view, what is going to be necessary to make judicial estoppel apply in this particular case.
Well, if the order was on a stipulation, and the stipulation said it was Ryan's property, and then the court makes an order based on Ryan's property, why isn't that judicial estoppel?
Well, because I guess from my perspective, when you look at Seaview and you look at the Godfrey case, you're talking about an asserting a position and you're convincing the court. What we're trying to do here is prevent a fraud in the court. In other words, you've taken a position. You've tried to convince the court that you're taking a position on something, and now later on you're going somewhere else and doing something differently. There wasn't any attempt to try and take a position with regards to ownership there.
Did Mr. Ryan say, hey, court, I don't get any fees or assistance for moving or storage of this barge because this barge is not mine?
Incorrect.
Did he do that in the previous case?
No,
hey, the barge is not mine. I'm not responsible for any of this. I don't get any money for moving it or for storing it. I have nothing to do, and I have no ability to move this because this barge is not mine. Is that the message he sent to the court when the court made its findings?
No, and that would be an incorrect message to send.
Is it his barge or not?
He had lien rights in it. Just like, for instance, there were two categories of property generally that are relevant here on the site. One where there were a whole ton of vehicles that his company towed and stored here on the site. Plus there was this barge there being stored in the same way. As part of the agreement, all these vehicles, most of which Ryan and his companies also did not own, they were paid money to take those properties off or those vehicles off the site because it was paying him for the fact that he was a bailee. He had he had lien rights in the property for his storage rights. So he wasn't an owner, but he was a lien holder.
So he never represented that was his personal property?
Not that he never represented he owned it, but he did represent, and I'll be here to represent that today. He had interest in those properties. He had a lien right, just like a bank would have a lien on a property. You may not be the owner, but you have lien rights. He had lien rights in this property. The law gives him that, just like he had lien rights in the vehicles, and the state paid him for the vehicles.
Counselor, the state asserts that he was paid nothing for the barge or for moving it to a new location as part of the relocation efforts that went along with the condemnation of the real estate. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, he was never paid for that. The reason he wasn't paid for that, and of course this is the testimony from Mr. Markovitz in the penalty phase of the lower court proceeding, was that he had an understanding with the state is that because moving this barge and storing it, like they did with the furniture and the cars, was going to be very expensive. And they thought, hey, it's going to be sitting out in the river. It's going to be anchored to the shore. It's not going to interfere with us. Why don't we just leave it here? And then we won't have to pay all these storage fees. So Mr. Markovitz thought, that's fine. So that's why nothing was paid, is because during that 12-month storage period, instead of moving it to some other site and the state having to chip out some dollars, they were able to leave it right there and save that money.
Okay, thank you.
So, no, he has not been paid, but there was a quid pro quo. They were going to take care of it. And I'll get into that when we deal with the third issue.
Counsel, tell me what that third issue is again. I understood your first two issues. What's the third issue application?
The application of Commerce Rule 202, it's actually 0.521 paren B, I believe is what it is.
202.51B. I took from your
It's in the footnote 3 on page 6 of our reply brief.
Okay. And it's cited in your main brief at 12, 35, and 36,
yeah.
Right?
Exactly. The relevant passage is cited there. Go ahead.
It says, a person who claims a moving payment based on actual and reasonable cost shall be eligible for the following expenses, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right.
I always like to try to get centered on what the issues are in the case. In your statement of issues, in your brief in chief, in essence, you have four issues, but I think they're boiled down to three. One is the judicial estoppel issue that you listed at the beginning of your comments today. The second was, can you have summary judgment in this kind of a proceeding? And I understood a third issue to be whether or not, if you can, whether or not summary judgment was appropriately granted. Stated in your brief, in chief, you say essentially whether or not they're genuine issues of material fact. That's what I understood the issues to be, and yet your statement of issues at the beginning of your presentation this morning didn't have that genuine issue of material facts stuff. Is that an issue? Is it not an issue?
It was part of my summary judgment. In other words, I said the second one was summary judgment and its relationship to a forfeiture proceeding. And part of that is exactly what you're addressing.
So you have that really divided into two. Can
yes.
you
so
have summary judgment of forfeiture? And if you can, then should summary judgment have been granted here?
Exactly.
Got it now. Thanks for your clarification.
I'll go on to that second issue then. The summary judgment issue, Your Honors, is basically since judicial estoppel has not been shown here because there wasn't the assertion, there wasn't the convincing that's required in the writ case. Everything that's cited there is one, it's either not in the proceeding or the other is just the order of the court that the parties agreed to just to get the thing over with and be done. There was no intent to deceive anybody, to mislead anybody. It was a matter of just completing the process so that the state, the DOT, could get control of the property.
If you don't have judicial estoppel, what are the material facts in dispute?
Well, if you don't have judicial estoppel, you don't have the issue of ownership and control having been issued. Because that's what leads into this summary judgment. The trial court, the circuit
so
court.
So if you don't have summary judgment, you have an issue of who owns the barge.
Or who controls it.
Or who controls it,
exactly.
Right? All right. And you could have someone owning it and another entity controlling it.
Could very well, yeah.
And who's liable under the Forfeiture Act?
Well, the language seems to suggest it could be an owner or a controller. The language is broad enough there. I guess it could be that way. The problem comes in is that the statute requires getting a permit. And if you look at a permit can only be obtained by an owner, which kind of ties and says, well, you got to be an owner to get a permit. And if you can't get the permit and you're a violation of the statute.
You need a permit to have something in a navigable stream.
Yes, okay. Exactly.
And
put
there's
it on
no
the
permit here by.
No, but it's kind of a catch-22 because the only people that can get a permit are the owner. So that kind of is the catch-22 issue. I haven't spent a lot of time on that, and I wasn't planning on spending a lot of
time.
Right,
and that really moves us into the third issue, namely who's the owner and who had control, and your point of the regulation is that was controlled by the state in that year.
That's good. That's part of that
third
issue.
That's your point, right.
Yes.
That's the third.
That's part of the third issue.
Okay. Let's get back to your second issue. Why don't you think you can have, as I understand your second issue, you don't think that in a violation under Chapter 30 that you can have summary judgment at all, period. Is that your position?
That's correct.
All right. Why not? That's your second issue, right?
Right. Well, there are a variety of reasons. We've addressed these in the proceedings, but I'll highlight what I think are the critical ones. The first of all is that as the Schneck case pointed out, the passage is cited, I believe, in our reply brief on page 17. If I get to the right, oh no, that's the wrong page here. I think it's 18. Yeah, on page 18 at the top, we cite where they talk about the forfeiture process. It says, the Supreme Court has noted many of the similarities in procedure between a forfeiture action and a criminal action. And the court has cautioned that, quote, it is an oversimplification to treat forfeiture actions as purely civil in nature. So that's our starting point. And where does that take us? Basically, we've also cited in there the case of the Landings, where the court has basically stated that where you have two sets of procedural rules or two sets of rules that affect a subject matter, the specific is going to control over the general. The summary judgment rules that the state is relying on here are the general summary judgment rules. We have pointed the court to the specific ones under Chapter 23 that are applicable here, and there are absolutely no references at all to summary judgment. In fact, if you look at those rules, you will see that they really stack up to and match up to a criminal-type proceeding. And so that's a real important consideration.
Isn't that an overstatement, counsel? There are two forms. They can be one form under 23, action, can be by citation, right?
Yes.
That looks like criminal to you?
From my years of doing criminal from way back when, yes, I try not to do criminal anymore, Your Honor.
Okay. But the other way of doing it is a complaint and summons.
Which can also be done in a criminal setting, too. I know that.
Yeah, but can be done in a civil setting.
Exactly.
Right.
I agree.
So here you had a summons, you had a complaint, you had an answer. Looks civil to me.
Exactly. There's nothing wrong with that. The problem is that how do you then process the summons and complaint? That's what's really more critical.
Okay, how do you process it?
Well, and that's what the procedural rules under, it's 23.50 to .85
okay.
that deal with that. If you look at those, and I'm not going to go through, in fact, I don't even have them all here to read, but they're between 23.50 to 23.85.
Right.
Those are the ones that you want to look at.
Right.
But here is something that I think this court does need to address, and I don't know if that's been clearly made in the submissions, but I'm going to direct you to page 16 of the reply brief, where we point out of 23.69, and this is language that both the state and we rely on, and we come to different conclusions.
That's 23.69 that says, any motion which is capable of determination without the trial of a general issue shall be made before trial.
Exactly. That
sounds like summary judgment.
It doesn't, Your Honor, but I think that's what this court has to decide. We look at it this way, and the language, we highlighted the language, which is capable of determination without the trial of the general issue. What we look at it this way is that you can bring a motion in this case as long as you don't affect the general issue that has to go to trial. You can bring that motion before trial. But it doesn't mean that basically you eliminate the trial. Now, that's how we've interpreted what this language means. The state obviously takes the opposite conclusion. Your Honor, you seem to think that that's also the case, and maybe I don't have your vote on this one. But that's an issue. That's an issue that...
Up so quickly.
So bad.
You think it's a six... Well, it'd be 5-1. You'd be happy with that.
My point is, Your Honor, is that is critical. And I think there is no clear enunciation about how this clause is supposed to be interpreted. This court has not interpreted that. But I think what's happened here in this case shows that there's probably an ambiguity here.
Well, what about a statute of limitations defense?
What about state,
well, would that be allowed in this case under 2369?
Well, a statute of limitations defense, like a that would be allowed, or like any motion to dismiss, because that doesn't get to the if you're going to try the ultimate issue, or if the ultimate issue has to be decided, this language is saying that's reserved for trial. You've got to
have a summary judgment. You don't have to decide the ultimate issue. If you win on a summary judgment, the end.
I understand that, Your Honor, but here's the difference.
Okay.
I do a lot of civil work now. After 6 years of criminal practice, I went solely to civil. And I've been a trial lawyer all my life. And when you do civil litigation, I've been in a number of cases where the other side pops right out with a summary judgment motion. And what I've been able to do in every case that I've had is I've gone to the judge and say, Your Honor, this motion is here, but we want to have this motion continued out because we want to take some depositions of the other side. And the court will grant that request. I've never had that request denied. They always grant it. So that, in other words, when you go ahead with summary judgment, before that hearing is going to be heard, I have never had a judge yet turn down my request to cross-examine the other side on key issues. In a forfeiture action, I cannot do that because the rules say there is no discovery. So what happens, I have summary judgment. Mr. Ryan is basically convicted, and I've never had a chance to cross-examine anybody. Anybody. That, to me, is a very, very crucial difference here that I don't think we need, that I think we need to make sure we don't lose sight of. That's very important.
Well, you were allowed to put in affidavits, weren't you?
That's fine. But affidavits are not enough, or cannot be enough. But in this case, and this gets to the third part, what Justice Bradley was getting at, is in this particular case, the court basically rejected Mr. Ryan's affidavit saying that he had 15 years of experience keeping this barge afloat. And he explained how what the state had done had caused this thing to sink. The judge totally disregarded that and said, you're not an expert. You don't have an expert witness in here. Out of here. I'm not even going to listen to you. So he created a fact dispute through an affidavit, and the court totally rejected it. And I think that's totally inappropriate in this case. Mr. Ryan, having handled it for 15 years, is certainly qualified to give that kind of testimony.
Let's just double back a minute.
Yep.
If the state put in an expert witness, which it did through an affidavit, and you put in nothing, no expert witness, would there be summary judgment? Assuming summary judgment was permissible in this kind of lawsuit.
Not if we have submitted evidence that would create a disputable fact.
The point was that you had to submit expert evidence. Do you think that's correct ruling?
No, I do not. I don't.
Why not?
Well, unless you want to call Mr. Ryan an expert, but I don't think it's where.
Well, did you call him an expert?
No,
was he
didn't.
An expert?
We didn't have to call him an expert. We didn't think we had to call him an expert. He was a fact witness that dealt with the subject matter at issue. When you're dealing with civil litigation, you can have any. You don't have to be an expert to be able to testify about the facts that you've actually done. You can. It's advisable. I do it in most of the cases I do. In other words, in eminent domain, where I spend most of my time, I can have my owner testify to value. But if I rest my case without calling in an expert to give the opinion of value, I would be an idiot and a fool. So the point is that you can have a non-expert provide evidence about factual issues, which is exactly what Mr. Ryan did, and he had 15 years of experience. So that does not mean he should be eliminated from consideration. Maybe he's not going to be as credible as an expert. In this case, based upon what we learned in the penalty phase, he was actually a lot more credible than their expert, but we were never able to cross-examine their expert before the summary judgment motion to find that out. It came about afterward. Not a consideration, but it just reinforces why this summary judgment proceeding without being able to do discovery is really an inappropriate procedure in a forfeiture proceeding.
Well, thank you, Mr. Beersdorf. Your red light is on, and you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Thank you. Assistant Attorney Joanne Kloppenberg, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General Joanne Kloppenberg, representing the plaintiff state of Wisconsin. The Court should affirm the grant of summary judgment to the state on Ryan's liability because, at the summary judgment stage, it was undisputed that Ryan owned, possessed, and controlled the barge, that DOT had not taken that control away from him, and that DOT had not caused the barge to sink. The state also believes that judicial estoppel applies. When Ryan was trying to get money from DOT for relocation assistance in the writ proceeding, he claimed the barge is his. When that failed and the barge became a liability that would cost him money to remove, he said that the barge was no longer his. But even if judicial estoppel doesn't apply, Ryan's admissions of ownership, possession, and control in the writ proceeding, in the eminent domain case, and in this case, plus his failure to establish DOT control or causation in response to summary judgment, make summary judgment against him proper and appropriate. Finally, summary judgment is proper and appropriate in this civil action because the Chapter 23 procedures, particularly Sections 23.53.55, 23.69, and 23.73, can be reconciled with the provisions of Section 802.08 and all of its subsections. And I think I will discuss that issue first so that we can clear the decks and show that summary judgment is an appropriate procedure here. We start with 801.802, which says that the civil procedure statutes govern all civil actions except where different procedure is prescribed by statute. So you follow the analysis in Schneck to see whether the Chapter 23 procedures can be reconciled with summary judgment procedures, and they can. First, 23.55 allows for the filing of a summons and complaint and the response in an answer, which happened here. So you have the two pleadings that you start the summary judgment methodology
with. Suppose this had been brought by citation. Could you have summary judgment?
No.
So the determination of summary judgment depends on how the procedure is brought.
Correct.
Okay.
Once it's commenced with a summons and complaint and an answer, there's nothing in Chapter 23 that prevents the filing of supporting and opposing affidavits. And then you get to 23.73. Well, first 23.69, which allows for any motions that could resolve the case prior to trial. And Attorney Booker, when he presented argument for Mr. Ryan in the circuit court at the hearing on this issue, read 23.69 and said, no kidding, that's in every civil and criminal proceeding. The point is whether that's allowing for summary judgment is compatible with the procedures in Chapter 23. 23.73 prohibits discovery. Well, under Section 802.08 sub 4, the court may deny summary judgment where the opposing party shows that it cannot support its opposition by affidavit only. So, under Chapter 23, where discovery is not allowed, it's not an option, where the opposing party makes that Section 802.084 showing that, quote, it cannot for reasons stated present by affidavit facts essential to justify the party's opposition, unquote, then the court can deny the summary judgment motion and let the case proceed to trial.
How do you get around 2373 that says neither party is entitled to pretrial discovery?
By the provision in 802.08 sub 4, where a party shows that they need discovery to oppose summary judgment, then the court can deny summary judgment and let the case proceed to trial. In this case, Mr. Ryan did not make that showing, and he could not have made that showing.
I'm still having problems with fitting it together with the words in 2373. What you're saying to me is that the summary judgment statute modifies the forfeiture chapter. Right?
No, I'm saying that the forfeiture chapter can be reconciled with the summary judgment provision by the fact that in the summary judgment procedures, it provides authority for the court to deny summary judgment where a party makes a showing that they need discovery in order to oppose summary judgment. And since in 2373 you can't have discovery, then you have to deny the summary judgment motion and let it proceed to trial.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
I want to go back to 2355. So I'm starting with the, you can do a citation or a complaint in summons. And the focus of my inquiry is whether or not the procedures in 23 can be reconciled with the civil procedures regarding summary judgment. Am I correct that when a summons and complaint form is submitted under 23.55, that there is no requirement that the defendant file an answer?
Correct. The defendant had the option to appear in court.
Yeah, that's what I understand. I'm looking at 23.55 sub 2 sub B, and that tells us what the summons says. And the summons says that the defendant has to appear in court at a specified date, not less than 10 days following the service of the summons, to answer the complaint. So it seems like it's different than the what I would consider the normal rules of civil procedure in a normal summons and complaint, because the summons says you have so much time to file an answer, right? Here, there's no requirement to filing an answer. There is a requirement that you appear at the time and date set forth in the summons, and if you don't, then essentially set forth in C, a notice that in the case of failure to appear, judgment may be rendered against the defendant according to the demand. So he's got to, or she's got to show up, but there's no formal answer to be filed.
Correct. And in this case, as in others that the Department of Justice has brought, other Chapter 30 actions, the parties agree that the defendant will waive his or her appearance and instead file an answer to the complaint. And that's what happened here.
One of the concerns I have in this case is here you have a written answer, and here you have affidavits. But my sense is, in a lot of, I shouldn't say that, my sense is under the statute, there's certainly allowance for commencing an action by citation, which you say you can't do by summary judgment. But there's also under this chapter the ability to do it by summons and complaint and still have no answer, and still have no affidavits. In this case, we do, but I'm concerned that the argument maybe paints too broadly, because in some summons and complaint cases, pursuant to the statute, there need not be a written answer, and there need be no ergo affidavits.
Your Honor, Justice Bradley, the affidavits came in response to the summary judgment motion. That came long after the complaint and answer were filed. And the court could clarify Schneck and say that where a summons and complaint has been filed and the defendant appears in court and pleads not guilty, that's in effect a denial of all of the factual allegations in the complaint. And therefore, you've got the issues have been joined and you can proceed to summary judgment.
You anticipate my very question, because we have what I refer to as boilerplate summary judgment methodology. And what does that methodology tell us? You go to any summary judgment case and we have it there, you know, boilerplate. The methodology is you examine the complaint to determine whether it states a claim. Then this boilerplate methodology says the court must review the answer to determine whether it joins a material issue of fact or law. Our standard methodology goes on to state if the two are sufficient to join issue, the court
examines the moving party's affidavits to determine whether they establish a prima facie case for summary judgment. And if the moving party establishes a prima facie case, then the court looks to the opposing party's affidavit to determine whether there are any material facts in dispute that entitle the opposing party to a trial. So that's our boilerplate methodology. It seems to me there's an argument that in some cases under 2355 that you are not going to be able to use the standard methodology because there will be no written answer to compare. None is required.
Well, but you will have the defendants pleading not guilty and putting all of the allegations of fact at issue. And then it's up to either side to move for summary judgment and support their motion and have the other side oppose their motion with affidavits that flesh out the facts. And if, upon a motion for summary judgment, the defendant makes a showing that they cannot oppose summary judgment just based on their own affidavits, but they need to do discovery, then the court can deny summary judgment and let the case proceed to trial. So that the methodology, the boilerplate methodology, can be followed. It was followed here in this case. And at summary judgment, there was no dispute as to Ryan's ownership, control, and possession of the barge. At summary judgment, there was no dispute that DOT had not taken control of that barge away from him. And at summary judgment, there was no dispute that DOT's cutting of the chains did not cause the barge to sink.
Counselor, wasn't there no dispute about the ownership and control of the barge at summary judgment because of the court's imposition of judicial estoppel on that fact?
Judge Foley did find, based on judicial estoppel, there was no dispute. I'm telling the court here now that in the alternative, well, first I should back up. Judicial estoppel was proper because if you look at the petition for the writ, which the...
I just want to back you up a little bit. My question to you is more simple.
Okay.
If we were not employing judicial estoppel, would there be an issue of material fact in regard to ownership and control of the barge at summary judgment?
No, there would not. Because the conclusory state, there was one affidavit from Mr. Ryan before the court on the state's first motion for summary judgment. And in that affidavit, he talked about the Schumacher incident where he prevented Schumacher from taking the barge away. And in paragraph 16 of his affidavit, where he tries to say that there was an option exercised by DOT to store the barge for him, he talks about all of his company's property, B.E. Ryan Enterprises, the corporation's property, of which he was the sole director, officer, manager, controller, that he says in paragraph 16 of his affidavit, all of the property of the corporation, including the barge. So in his own affidavit, he calls the barge his own.
Well, he has explained that he has lien rights on it, too. So, I mean, I understand your interpretation.
And his affidavit, his conclusory statements that, well, his only relationship with the barge was as an employee of the corporation. In prior deposition proceedings and at a prior hearings, he had said that the barge belonged to Ryan Marina, that belonged to B.E. Ryan Enterprises, and he was the only officer, the president, the managing director of all of those entities. So his prior deposition testimony controls over any contrary statements in this affidavit. But even in his affidavit, he refers to the barge as the corporation's property. And he showed how he exercised his control over the barge by not letting anybody else take it away.
If this was his or the corporation's property, why didn't the state pay him to store this property as it did for the cars over which he was also the bailee?
The answer is found in two places below. On summary judgment, where I think the court needs to focus, because The court, as an alternative to judicial estoppel, which we still think is appropriate, the issue of his ownership and control and possession of the barge was undisputed. At summary judgment, the DOT affiance stated that DOT had never taken title, possession, or control over the barge. They'd never received a request from Mr. Ryan to store the barge.
You're on a different page than I'm on. I want to know why they didn't pay him a relocation expense for the barge if it was his property. That's the answer.
Right.
Question
and
I need answered.
And they said it's because there are several reasons. One, as a matter of fact and of law, it was not eligible for relocation assistance because it was not part of an ongoing business and it was not his tangible property located on real property. And I go through in my brief, when you follow through the COM rules, 202, he's entitled to relocation assistance, reimbursement for his expenses for moving or storing his own property, his own personal property. Personal property is defined as tangible property on real property. This barge was not on real property. It was not part of an ongoing business that was to be relocated somewhere else. And he never asked to be reimbursed for any expenses associated with moving or storing the barge. So that's why DOT never paid him any money. It turns out, when we had the hearing, that was fleshed out, that the barge didn't get in the way of DOT's operations using that site for the highway project. So they just let Ryan keep his barge there because it was not interfering in their, and with their work.
So you're telling me that even if he moved it, DOT would not have had to pay him to store it while he found another location for it because it wasn't personal property that was on top of real estate? Is that what you're telling me?
And not part of an ongoing business. DOT was
well,
not...
It wasn't part of his business storing on the relocation form that somebody put in their appendix. It says his business was storing automobiles and one barge. Storage of barge and boats.
And the DOT affiant, Hutnick, stated that, I believe this was in the affidavit, that at that point they had determined that was not part of, that was not an ongoing business at the time, that all the records that Ryan presented to them show that the only business had to do with his cars.
So he could store cars at that time but wasn't storing boats regardless of what the relocation business questionnaire said about his business.
That's what DOT determined once they fleshed out, you know, got his tax returns or whatever they get from him to okay. determine what is ongoing and what's not. But the key here is that he kept his barge there, but then he did not keep up his responsibility for the barge. The fact that DOT didn't pay attention to the barge is consistent with their not having taken control over the barge. In his affidavit, and we have to go back to the affidavit at summary judgment, he talks about how his attorney told him that DOT was required to store the barge and that that option to store was exercised. He never submitted an affidavit from his attorney identifying to whom the attorney spoke at DOT, when he spoke, who agreed, how they agreed to store the barge. There's no reference to any email, to any conversation, to any person at DOT, to any date. He had all that. If there were such information, he could have presented it. He could have presented an affidavit from his attorney. He could have himself said, I understood that I had the right to have DOT store the barge for me as my property, and I exercised that right by doing this. He never talked about how he exercised that right. His affidavit was not sufficient to refute the hard factual statements that were made by the DOT affiants that DOT had never taken over control of the barge and had never agreed, never received a request from Mr. Ryan to do anything about the barge. So it was at the first summary judgment stage with his first affidavit, there was nothing in that affidavit to refute the statements that were in prior deposition testimony or the statement in the writ that the barge was his and his entity's. On the second motion for summary judgment, Judge Cooper found the man behind the curtain of those entities was Mr. Ryan. And the prior deposition testimony, the prior hearing testimony, the writ, all showed that Mr. Ryan was and is the person who owns, controls, and possesses this barge.
Counsel, why isn't the second affidavit of Mr. Ryan sufficient to put in dispute the ownership? Paragraph 2 of the second affidavit of Mr. Ryan indicates, as I've repeatedly stated, I've never personally owned the barge. In paragraph 2, he attaches Exhibit A, which is a copy of the barge's certificate of title listing the owner as KOOP Marine, Inc., and he also attaches Exhibit B, which is the Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions listing for KOOP Marine, Inc., and showing that Richard Schumacher is the registered agent. Why isn't ownership by these averments sufficient to put that?
For three reasons. The first reason is that that affidavit was submitted after the court had already ruled that he or his entities owned, possessed, and controlled the barge.
This was on motion for reconsideration?
This was a motion for reconsideration and in response to the state's second motion for summary judgment just on his personal liability. So it was too late. It was filed too late. Second, it's a sham affidavit because it was that statement that he never personally owned the barge and his relationship is only as an employee of the corporation that had lien rights over the barge is contradicted by many statements he had made in prior deposition testimony. This is all identified in the state's brief. And by the court's by the writ and by the petition for the writ that had been filed by the state, and by his questionnaire, which identify the barge as his property, by his own statement in paragraph 16 of his first affidavit, where he talks about the corporation, all of the corporation's property, including the barge. The third reason is that certificate that's attached, the KOOP certificate, is back from, I think, 1996, and it's just a certificate that he can use that barge for that year. It is not a title. He has nothing to show that in 2005 and 2006, he and his entities did not and still do not own, control, and possess the barge.
Why is that his burden to show and not the state's?
The state showed that he owned, possessed, and controlled it.
Did it owe title in him?
No. Used his own statements.
Okay.
We used his own statements.
But you agree it's the state's burden of proof?
Oh, yes. That was an element. And in fact, we believe judicial estoppel is appropriate, but if it's not, the state in its first motion for summary judgment, you look at the state's brief and the state's reply brief. In both those briefs, the state provides two other grounds for summary judgment. One, that Ryan owned the barge because of his prior statements and the writ, finding that the barge was his. Two, that he controlled the barge, that DOT had not taken control away from the barge. So those were before the judge on summary judgment. And those propositions were undisputed by him at that stage. And
the state determines whether there's summary judgment by the way it brings the proceeding, in other words.
Pardon, I'm sorry.
The state controls whether there'll be summary judgment by the way the state brings the proceeding.
Yes.
Let me follow up the chief's question. And that gets me to the Schneck case, which you, of course, cited in your brief and you made reference to earlier in oral argument. If I heard your comment correctly, and sometimes I do, sometimes I don't, earlier you suggested maybe the court's going to have to add or amplify
or do something with the Schnitt case. I can't remember your exact...
I said clarify.
Clarify. Thank you. That is exactly it. In, on page 42, and you don't need to look at page 42 of your brief for my question, but you characterize the Schnitt case and say, quoting from Schnitt, you say, summary judgment procedures inconsistent with and unworkable in a WSSTAT Chapter 345 forfeiture proceeding, unquote. Then the brief continues. The court reasoned that summary judgment methodology begins with examination of the pleadings to determine whether issues are joined. But in Chapter 345 traffic cases, there are no responsive pleadings joining the issue, only citations and pleas. Please. So please, let's focus on the please.
Right, because
that's the problem here.
Right. Here you could have a summons and complaint and a plea. And the state's position would be, I think it has to be, that that's sufficient to join issue and open the door for a motion for summary judgment.
But in your description of the Schnitt case and its reasoning, and let me stretch and say maybe it's holding, I don't know, but let me say, anyway, you have in here what its reasoning is, that it's not sufficient, as I understand it, the sentence that I'm quoting. The court reasoned that summary judgment methodology begins with examination of the pleadings to determine whether issues are joined. But in Chapter 345 traffic cases, there are no responsive pleadings joining the issue, only citations and pleas. We have here, of course, the opportunity for just use of citation. We have opportunity also for a summons and complaint with no requirement for a written answer. Just show up and plead. What are we to do?
But here, this is not a citation.
Right.
There was much more to it. It was a summons and complaint. Then issue was joined. In this case, there was an answer filed, and the summary judgment methodology could proceed. In other cases where the court has tried to decide whether summary judgment is appropriate or not, they have looked to the procedures. In Hyndman, H-Y-N-D-M-A-N, they said summary judgment's not appropriate in criminal actions because the pleadings and the timing associated with summary judgment and amendment of the pleadings and cross-claims and counterclaims, all those things are foreign to criminal actions. And Stephen V., Justice Sykes' decision, that there, summary judgment is not incompatible with procedures in the unfitness phase of the termination of parental rights actions. Again, they went to look at whether determining whether there are disputed issues of fact is compatible with the substantive procedures in the case before the court. The focus is on the procedures.
This is the question.
Okay.
Because the time is running out. I want to get to it. In this forfeiture proceeding, in a forfeiture proceeding, where there is a summons and complaint issued, no written answer, and only a person showing up pursuant to the summons to enter a plea, is summary judgment appropriate under the reasoning of Schnitt?
Under the reasoning of Schnitt, I would say yes, because the issues have been joined.
What do you do with the language, only there are no responsive pleadings joining the issue, only citations and pleas?
Because you can't look at the pleas part without looking at the citation part. There is no joining of the issues under the meaning of the summary judgment statute when you have a citation. But there is such a joining of an issue of the issues when you have a long-form complaint such as that was filed here. So summary judgment can be reconciled with the procedures in Chapter 23. And it isn't good policy to preclude summary judgment where no facts are in dispute, saving the resources of the parties, the courts, and juries. And there is a safeguard where an opposing party shows that the discovery bar prevents them from establishing a dispute of material fact outside of their own knowledge and resources. Here, Ryan's burden was simple had he had the evidence. He could have... I'm sorry, my red light is up. May I just conclude?
Pardon me, I'm sorry.
Conclude my red light.
I have a question for you, though, okay. Which is I was looking up, and I'm sorry I missed you. You keep referring to the writ proceeding.
Yes.
And depositions and material in that writ proceeding. Why is that all part of this proceeding?
The depositions actually are from the eminent domain case.
Okay, why are they both part of this proceeding?
The state used them for two reasons. One, to use Ryan's own statements to prove his ownership, control, and possession of the barge. So those were evidentiary.
So they
facts.
Were put in as in the summary judgment motion.
Correct. They
okay.
Were, yes. The second reason would be to support judicial estoppel, that the petition for the writ, well, the questionnaire that set in motion those proceedings, the petition for the writ, and then the issuance of the writ all showed that Ryan had presented to the court somehow through his attorney, through agreements and statements made and representations in the language of the petition for the writ, that there is common ownership and control by Basil Ryan and representation by the same counsel. That was in the petition for the writ. And then the judge issues the writ requiring Basil and his companies to remove their barge. The state used that language to support its judicial estoppel argument. But it also used those two pieces of evidence plus deposition testimony plus other instances of Ryan's own statements to show Ryan's ownership, possession, and control of the barge.
Thank you, Ms. Glavenberg.
Thank you very much.
Are there any other questions? Thank you. Mr. Beersdorf, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I'll try and be quick here. First point I'd like to make, it makes no sense to me that the procedure controlled by the state is going to dictate whether or not you have summary judgment or you don't have summary judgment in a forfeiture proceeding. It's got to be either one way or the other. You cannot, and the state should not control how that is. So if the state's acknowledging that by citation you don't get summary judgment, it makes no sense to me that just because they choose to go summons and complaint, that should somehow change the rules of the game as far as procedures for handling the case is concerned.
Doesn't that happen all the time in the criminal context? The state can charge a forfeiture proceeding, they can charge a forfeiture proceeding, or they can charge a criminal proceeding, and as a result of that kind of a citation or a complaint, you have a whole different set of procedures.
Since I'm not a criminal lawyer, I can't answer that question. That may be true. All I'm saying is it does not make any sense here. It doesn't make sense to me. That's a common sense argument on my part. The court may come to a different conclusion.
He didn't have to answer. He could have just pled.
Yes, but apparently and this was before we were involved, apparently they had an agreement where he would come in or that they would do an answer instead of coming in. I'm sure even his attorney at that point didn't realize that that was going to have an impact on how the case would play out. And that's why I think a clarification by the court here in this case on that rule will be very important, because if attorneys now know that their clients' rights are going to be affected by the procedure that's going to apply, whether or not they appear or whether they answer, that's going to make a big difference in terms, I would think, about how attorneys representing clients in forfeiture cases would actually defend the case. Second point I wanted to make is that the boilerplate that Justice Bradley was talking about was not followed in this particular case. And basically what the court did is Ryan did support in the original affidavit disputed facts, or did make averments that would amount to disputed facts. The fact is that the court basically said, I'm not going to listen to you, Mr. Ryan, because you're not an expert. And our whole contention was, because he was not an expert, that should not eliminate his ability to raise a disputed fact, particularly here where we believe he was eminently qualified to address those particular issues. The third point I think I want to address here is the barge not being part of the business and not being on the real property. That is crazy. The fact of the matter is that...
Do you have any authority for that citation?
Crazy. Pardon me, Your Honor. Okay. I get a little excited sometimes.
Apparently.
But, I mean, he was in this, whether he's currently doing that business now, the fact of the matter is it was part of his business. The barge was there, and the fact that a barge is in the water, if it's anchored to the real estate, the fact that it's not actually sitting on the shore...
Was it anchored to the real estate, or was it anchored to trucks that were on the real estate?
The trucks were the anchor for the barge to the real estate. So my point is that it was anchored to the real estate, and for something like the barge or any personal property item that is going to be qualifying for relocation because it's not physically on the real estate, then every item that floats in the water, every boat, is never going to qualify under the state's definition. Lastly, the summary judgment motion was issued with regards to the judicial estoppel. That was the basis for why they came to that argument. If judicial estoppel does not apply, all the other arguments the state is talking about, those are disputed facts that need to go to trial. And those were the facts that, in fact, Ryan did address in his affidavit. So those are disputed facts. Those should go to trial, and there should be no question about that. So if judicial estoppel is not applying, then we should be going back and going to trial. Which leads to the last point, which I never really got to in the last one, is what about Rule 202, 521D? One of the things that the court needs to address here is what does that – there's a 12-month recognition in there, and it does talk about reimbursing property, but then it also talks about what do you do when you don't actually have to – when you're storing the property on the property itself as opposed to moving it somewhere else and incurring expenses. Does the agency have liability for those 12 months? That's critical. If they have liability, then per se, there is no response – there is no question here that this charge against Ryan has to be dismissed. Two other issues, though, that were brought out in the affidavit that need to go to trial. One, was there an agreement? Was there an agreement between the DOT and Markowitz on behalf of Ryan for storing the barge there? If there was, this is an issue that needs to go to trial. The state has, by clear and convincing evidence, has to show that there is not such an agreement. And then the third point is the fact that cutting of these chains, which even their expert said he didn't even know that there were chains involved there. That if you look at the pictures, those chains are huge that held this thing, held it to the tow trucks behind this huge cement wall. Those were huge. They cut them. That's also a fact question that needs to go to the jury that clearly establishes or addresses the control issue. Either dead.
The DOT cut the chains.
Yes.
Why?
We don't know. He never said why. We don't know. All we know is that they said, yeah, the chains were cut.
Okay, thank you.
That's the testimony in the record. The chains were cut. So that could...
Did they say they cut the chains?
He just said the chains were cut. We don't know. We weren't there. They didn't know. They didn't say.
Is the lien anywhere in the record, the lien that Mr. Ryan has on the barge?
Well, the lien is... There's no formal lien document, if you know what I'm saying. Basically, it's a lien right that's granted by statute. So it's like a auto repairman would have on a, you know, doing work, same kind of thing.
Did he ever pursue, and I don't want to know why or why not, but did he ever pursue a lawsuit against whoever owned the barge to...
He had not yet, no. He had not, shall I say, perfected his lien rights. He still had them, but he had not gone and done the judicial perfection, which would have transferred it to ownership.
Or just sought, you know, money judgment against whoever owned the barge and then sought relief of whoever owned the barge to get the barge out of there.
Right. He had not done that. I'm not sure that that's dispositive of the case here, but...
I just wondered if there was a record somewhere out there.
But the last point that I want to make sure that the court realizes with regards to that the factual issue is that...
Make it fast, your red light's on.
The cutting of the chains, that's also a dispute that should actually go and be heard by the jury, and that was addressed in the original affidavit.
When did you first assert Administrative Rule COMM? Did you assert it at the trial court?
Oh, yeah, we did there. I don't remember at what point it was. I know it was asserted there.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
So ends our hearing on a second case involving this eminent domain issue, although of a different nature and not necessarily connected with the one. Didn't we just hear that? within the last couple of months. And I want to thank Mr. Beiersdorf and Ms. Kloppenberg for their excellent arguments. That ends 09AP3075, State versus Ryan Jr. The court is in recess until it is next oral argument. The students should remain if they can, so that they can meet with Justice Rogensack. And the court will meet in a conference at 1:30. We are in recess.